All right, welcome back to the Beast Mentality Podcast. I'm Deshaun Beasley, your host. Today, I'm joined by Els. I'm going to let her introduce herself and give us three things we're grateful for.
Wow. How do I introduce myself?
First name, last name,
That's a
first name,
classic.
IG name. You can leave out the last name if you don't want to
Okay.
get searched on Google.
Yeah, let's do that. I'm Els. I live in London. I am 28, and I don't want to give my job because I don't feel that that really represents my ambition or my identity. But I write, I read a lot, I like being active, and I have a lot of thoughts.
And three things you're grateful for.
I finally had this conversation with a friend recently, and the first one that came to mind was, well, gratitude for my parents, specifically in the sense that although we've never been, hugely financially well off or been like super comfortable, I've always felt that I've got a safety net. I've always felt that I could take a risk or take a jump or try something or follow any ambition I had because they would be there or there'd be a community there, which I think is an incredible privilege. So that's probably number one. I'm really grateful for my room at the moment, my little bedroom. I'm in my own space and it feels really like a sanctuary. I like retreating there a lot. We had this conversation earlier, but I'm definitely an introvert. I love social things and interactions, but I then need to take time to recharge, and I have a space now that feels good for that. And I am grateful for connections with cool people.
Amen. Likewise, likewise, likewise. So, I just wanted to, like we talked earlier, want to dive into like your story. What got you, how you got to 28, God willing, not everybody makes it there. Then there's obviously things that we overcome in the process that makes us who we are. And then as we get older, if we don't air quote like who we are, we can start to change those things. So I just wanted to dive into like your
That's
story.
true.
Yeah, let's get into the meat and bones of it.
So I think I was always I had a reputation at school from, year one, like reception, so five or six. My first teacher told my mum in like a school report that I was a teacher's dream, and that kind of forged this identity that saw me throughout school. And I never felt it. I never felt super academic or capable, but everyone else seemed to think that I was. And it became this like real fear of mine that suddenly everyone would see what I saw and would realize that they were wrong and that I wasn't this capable student or this good person, and this kind of illusion would shatter. And so I then just did everything I could to make sure that that facade never went. So I worked really, really hard. I was definitely the stereotype of a perfectionist, a straight A student. And I think because that felt so out of my control and I was constantly chasing this thing that wasn't true or real, I ended up developing an eating disorder, which I think retrospectively was definitely an attempt to regain control. Consciously, like at the time, I thought I just wanted to be smaller and take up less space. But now I can see that the restriction and the almost discipline of it gave me the sense of control, and that although everything else felt completely out of control, I could maintain this one thing.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, it was funny. I was really deceptive and quite manipulative about making sure nobody knew. I don't want to really get into it, in case it like sparks ideas, but would do all of these things to make sure nobody found out. And It was this like really deep fear that people would. But at the same time, I remember feeling so sad that no one noticed, and it kind of confirmed to me that people didn't care or people didn't know me. And it's funny how even at the time I could recognize these two conflicting thoughts, but never kind of put that together to form a coherent, like, okay, there's something we need to explore here. But yeah, eventually my mum found out, and I told a teacher actually, and they told my mum, and I went into treatment. I never wanted to stop. I think that was the biggest thing.
When you say stop, retrospectively looking back, stop. You didn't want to stop the control that you had, or was it the actual disorder? It was the control
I think it
factor.
was the control, and I think it was this thing of all of these people were then telling me, you have to do this, or this is something we need you to do, and you need to meet this weight. And that felt like them taking that control off me. And so I resisted it. I'm quite, I would say, intuitive, and I can read situations, and I know. I can understand people, and so I knew what they wanted to hear, and so I could say all the right things and give the illusion that everything was fine. And I ended treatment and came out of it, but it went on for probably a decade. Worst part of a decade. And then I was still, I was at uni, and that then triggered more stress and more feeling like I needed to do all this, like meet these expectations. And then I don't know. So I think my ex-boyfriend was a personal trainer, my first love. And he started introducing me to weight training, and my relationship, at least to begin with, wasn't super healthy with it, because there was still a real focus on body image and control and restriction. But it kind of, I see it as it was a stepping stone towards recovery, because it enabled me to maintain that control and still be very, very disciplined, macros and weighing food and body measurements and things. But if I wanted to see progress in weights and what I was doing, I had to eat. And I guess the locus of control switched from restriction of food to seeing weights go up and seeing the improvements and seeing, the numbers change became a real drive, and that was something I then had control over and I could be disciplined in. So while initially it was still quite restrictive and yeah, and not super healthy, it was a real progression. And then I think it just, I think I just became, I can't put my finger on like what changed. There wasn't a moment where I was like, I don't want to do this anymore.
I mean, it sounds like it was like when, as you were talking, I had like a visual run through my head of like a scoreboard where initially the scoreboard was like the locus of control, and I can control the score of the game by controlling what I'm eating. And then it became like, oh, the scoreboard is actually these weights. So as long as these weights are going up, I'm in a good space. So it became less about controlling what's going in and out. Well, it became more of that, but the frame, like the way we frame what we're going through or what we're doing kind of dictates how we're going to feel about it in a sense. Like that's one of the things that like I captured as you were like sharing. It's like what you focus on is what you get. I don't know the saying or the quote, but in a sense, like that's what I'm
Yeah,
hearing.
I think that's a really astute observation.
That's a good word. Astute. I might have to Google that one because I in context I know what it means. That's funny.
Yeah, that's, what was that word earlier? Equanimity.
Equanimity,
Equanimity.
equanimity.
Yeah, I think that's so true. But then gradually, this kind of restriction that had stayed but moved into perhaps a less damaging thing became just less restrictive in general. Like, I remember going out for a meal with my boyfriend at the time for the first time in years, and not worrying, not, you know, analyzing the menu beforehand, and feeling free to choose whatever and have a starter and a dessert. Yeah, so that kind of, that was the eating disorder bit, I guess. And I haven't had those kind of thoughts or desires to act on thoughts in a long time. I think what was interesting is I talked about control being the motivating factor, and I think part of that was I had for decades, for most of my life, crippling anxiety, real awful. I would get into these like ruminating spirals and would worry about worrying, and it was so destructive. And I think that's where I wanted control. And I think because I'd never, although the eating disorder behavior stopped, I hadn't addressed the cause of the anxiety, or I hadn't managed to change that. And so when I stopped enacting those behaviors, I developed health anxiety. So hypochondria, essentially, and would become really fixated on illnesses and convinced that I had them.
So you're saying, even though you fixed the scoreboard and you changed the way that you were looking at it, there was still something at the root that you didn't know was there, but you had to change the score in order to see.
Yes.
The thing. You gotta, didn't go. Gotta move the dirty clothes if you want to find the remote. Like.
What an analogy. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember my psychotherapist when I was young and in treatment for an eating disorder, she said, an eating disorder is a symptom rather than the cause. So it's like having a runny nose and a cough when you have a cold. It's not the cold in itself, it's those symptoms that let you know you have one. And so yeah, this house anxiety came out in my second year of uni, and it was crippling. I was fixated on melanoma, so like skin cancer, and would check all of my moles kind of every day. I would take pictures of them and Google all of this stuff and spend probably 2 or 3 hours a day in this kind of just spiral of panicking that I had this or I would develop it. And it was absolutely debilitating.
You actually brought it, so you actually manifested it upon yourself,
I think. Maybe. It's, yeah. So for the viewers or listeners, yeah. I had skin cancer last year, not melanoma, but basal cell carcinoma. I think mostly it is just because I'm fair and I've had some bad sunburns, and you know, statistically I am higher risk. But yeah, maybe it was a manifestation. But yeah, where was I? If I remember.
You're talking about you shifted the preoccupied,
yeah, and it was just really quite awful. And I was living at home at the time and commuting to uni, and I was really lucky to live in a beautiful countryside area, and would go for really long walks, like 2-3 hours, first thing in the morning, just get out and walk. And I don't think I even listened to music. I think it was just a space to be. I had a dog at the time who was my companion. And I remember I would go up a hill and then look out across the Somerset Levels, and something about seeing how vast everything was and how tiny that I was so, I can't think of the word or find the word for it, but it was just this, it kind of reset everything every time I was there. And if I was in a panic or in this anxious like state, it kind of hit the reset button. And I would just think, even if I have these awful things I'm convincing myself I have, and even if after, you know, going to the doctors or whatever, they tell me I've got this and it's this thing, do I want to have spent that time of my life being absolutely miserable? Or it just felt so such a waste of time when everything, we're a blip. Our time on this earth is minuscule. And I just, that was the first moment where I started to explore the actual anxiety as opposed to all of these symptoms. And something about recognizing that my experience, my world was so tiny. And, we're all the center of our own universe, right? Everyone is the key player. And for them, everything else is sort of orbiting around them. And so it's quite a liberating recognition because you realize that for these other people, these things that you might get so anxious about, whether it's a thing with a family member or a friend, or you've forgotten something, or you haven't done so well in work, it's the biggest deal for you because it's all orbiting around you. But for these other people, you're on the far outskirts of what's going on in their life, and they're not, it just doesn't matter. It's such a blip.
And is it really their job to even care?
So, yeah, I guess that was the real aha moment, was being outside and perspective. That's what I was looking for, getting perspective.
So I want to stay there because you talked about perspective, what you focus on, kind of attracting to yourself, as in, fixating on upon a scoreboard, whatever that scoreboard is. But we came the long way home, and I wanted you to share your story just because, like, you're in a season of your life now where, like, you're actually, like, going through therapy. Like, there's a lot of people who know that they have problems, like myself included. And just for the listeners out there, like, when it comes to therapy, I was telling Els, like, first therapist, we had like two or three sessions. Then she, on one of the calls, was like, yeah, I have cancer, so, like, we're not going to, like, be doing this anymore. I'm like, got it. Hopefully, but again, what you focus on, I'm like, did I call it? Somehow, in some way, in my head, I'm like, did I call it that? But anywho, and then the next one, same thing. We went through one or two sessions, had cancer. And then the third one, I guess he was recently going through a divorce, battling depression, and it just wasn't a great experience. But and it's something I plan on doing in the future. But it's also something that a lot of people kind of put on the back burner. And I think you said it, like, very, very eloquently. We're only on this earth for a blimp of time, and for us to spend that time worrying about things or fixating on certain things, like, it's taking away, and, like, taking away from our happiness and our joy. And I feel like through therapy, we can begin to move the dirty laundry so we can find the remote and turn it to whatever TV, whatever channel we want to turn it to. But why did you decide? Well, you had talked about through your eating journey that you were already meaning a psychoanalyst, psychotherapist, psychoanalyst, something like that. But I guess what kind of, like, re-sparked that want in you to, like, continue to, like, declutter the laundry, that shadow work?
Sure. I will come back to that. There was something that came up as you were talking, and I
You can keep
think
going. I'm gonna blow my nose. I can't. They
do we
got you.
want to pause it? Is that a thing we do,
I
or
mean, you can keep going. I can hear you still. No, it's great. It's great.
I think this idea of being a blip and not wanting to get so caught up in everything, and it's not a call to not care. It's not an encouragement of just pretending things are fine and ignoring everything and moving on. It's more about not resisting the feelings that you're having. And instead of this kind of false, everything's fine, I'm not affected, and this denial, just being curious about those feelings. And I think resistance is such a time-consuming and unnecessary thing. But to answer your question, the sort of psychiatrist I was seeing during the eating disorder era, I only saw him for, I think, less than 6 months, and it was more of a, it wasn't what I would term helpful. And I
It was
think I
more
was,
crisis
yeah, exactly.
prevention than.
I was so young and I didn't have the self-awareness to really benefit from exploring things in the way that I think you do when you're a bit older. So as maybe you can tell from my accent, I'm from the UK, and we are fortunate enough to have the National Health Service. So not everything, but some treatments are free. And I had gone through a breakup recently, or at the time recently, and had gone to see someone and was having a bit of a rough time, and they referred me, and I got 12 weeks of free therapy. So I think it came about because I wasn't struggling with the breakup in the sense of I was really depressed and I was, you know, going through this. It was more curiosity and wanting to understand what happened in that relationship and, you know, what I wanted to maintain and things that could change in order to have a healthier or a more fulfilling for me relationship next time. And also the fact that it was free. I think if I had to pay, there's just no way that I could afford it at the moment. So I am incredibly grateful for that. And what was the rest of your question? I went off on a real tangent.
Yeah, it was why you decided to get therapy, and I guess what are some of the things that you're discovering about yourself? How can I phrase this question? It's a two-part question, but like, what are some things you're discovering about yourself? And then what are some tools and some tactics that you're doing to separate yourself from the thoughts and the feelings that you're having?
So to answer the first bit before the questions, why I sort of decided to go for it as well as the fact it was free. I think, and I don't know if I can draw in the same way or if I'll just gesture.
Yeah, we got you.
Oh, look at this. Awesome.
Draw
Okay.
away. Draw
This is
away.
probably going to be a very clumsy drawing. But I think, so the first part is, I guess. Wee.
And if you're in podcast land, what she's doing right now is drawing a spiral.
What's meant to be a spiral. And then there's a little dot on each of the spiral circles in kind of parallel with each other. And I think so. A really helpful thing I heard once was when it feels like you're going round in circles and repeating the same mistakes and all of these things are happening again and again, actually, you're coming at that experience or that trigger or that habit with new experiences and new sort of coping mechanisms or lessons. And so while it feels like you're going around in circles, you're actually going around in more of a spiral and things are expanding as you go, which I think is a really beautiful thing. And I suppose it's how you use those lessons and use those things that you're picking up as to how big that spiral might expand. And I think I tend to be quite an introspective person and I think about things a lot and I analyze things a lot and I'm very good at intellectualizing things. And with therapy, it's felt like these spirals have just been sort of getting exponentially bigger. So while I might still have the same habits and I'm still unlearning things, as that's happening, you know, my experience and my understanding is growing more than it would have if I were alone. And I think I said it to you yesterday, it was almost like while I reflect a lot and have these thoughts, that therapist can sometimes ask you a question that takes you off the track that you usually go down and just trigger something new or
Give
yeah,
you a
just
different
create a shift in
perspective.
perspective, which helps with that expansion of experience and understanding. So that's yeah, that's kind of why I felt like I would benefit from it. And I think therapy, a lot of people go to it during times of crisis, in which time, you know, during that time that it is incredibly beneficial. But I think there's something to be said for going when you're in quite a stable position, because often in crisis, everything's so heightened that you might be quite dependent on your coping strategies. And so if any of those are removed, and you haven't yet had the time or the capacity or the support to build another one that's healthier, it can feel really disruptive. Whereas when you're in quite a stable, steady, quite content phase of your life, it feels like there's more capacity to shift things up and try new things and explore things that could be quite confronting or quite challenging. So yeah, it felt like a good time to do that. And some things I've learned. I feel like I'm just talking at you. I'm sorry.
I don't feel that way at all.
Things I've learned. There's been a lot of kind of exploration about attachment theory, which is the idea that the way that you relate and attach to people in your life, generally love sort of romantic relationships, but it can be platonic as well, is informed by your sort of your early relationship with your primary caregiver. And there's kind of four main attachment styles. There's anxious attachment, avoidant attachment, secure, and disorganized, which is kind of a mix of all of them. And you know, it's whether you are anxious or avoidant, anything that isn't secure, it doesn't necessarily mean that you were neglected by a parent, but it's the fact that parenting is hard. And there are times when a parent may not be able to meet that child's needs, whether that's because they've got four other children who also need attention, or they're a single parent, or that child is in hospital for a period of time and the parent cannot physically be there. You know, it's not a blaming of like it's the caregiver's fault that the child is an anxious attachment. It's just more these things happen and awareness is the best way to deal with it. So there's been a lot of exploring my attachment style, where that might have come from, acknowledging kind of how I feel about that, and then also exploring how that's informed my relationships with others, particularly in romantic contexts. And definitely self-worth has been coming up. And it's funny because I consciously right now I feel the most secure I've ever felt, and it's not necessarily a positivity sort of I think I'm great and I'm actively this person. It's more of a neutrality. It's which is kind of freeing because I don't feel like I need to be anything. It's just an acceptance, which I think acceptance can be such a beautiful thing. I think when the body positivity movement was kind of hijacked by social media and it kind of went a bit away from
It's
its
right.
origins, there was a kind of resistance movement called the body neutrality movement. And it was a thing of you don't need to, your body is an incredible thing that functions and lets you exist within it and lets you do all of these amazing things. So instead of focusing on loving your body, just focus on being in it, and it's your home, and you don't need to force this kind of, yeah.
Kind of like a false, like I don't want to say a false sense of like self-worth, but
But there's a pressure to perform, I think, when you have to be positive. And there's a feeling that if you don't, you're letting yourself down. And also this neutrality is more, you're worth more than body, you're worth more than any individual aspect of yourself. You are so right as you are, and you don't need to do anything or earn anything because you are.
yeah. And at the same time, if you want to change that, you're free to change it. And you have the space to
Yeah,
do so. Where I feel like,
exactly.
and this is my opinion, I feel like with sometimes with the body positivity, it's like, oh, I'm okay with who I am and how I am. And it's like, yes and no, but like you actually can't like continuously eat those things and not work out, like because you end up developing, heart disease and all these other things. So like yes, love yourself, but like love yourself enough to take care of yourself and appreciate yourself.
Yeah, I think it can be challenging to, or not conducive to accountability, and as you say, just an ability to reflect and see what can change, because whether it's in body or whether in mind or anything, I think change is so important, because everything around you changes all the time,
Yeah.
and adapting to that without feeling fear or feeling resistance is important. But sorry, to kind of go back, I guess. Yeah, I would say I'm the most secure I've been, but there's still these like little moments of, I think I've learned a lot of coping skills and ways to feel secure in myself, but again, that root hasn't quite been dug up yet. I've been able to make it look quite pretty on the outside, but maybe it's still there. So, every now and then she's asked a question or made a comment, and it's sobbed, and it's kind of really stirred up some feelings. So that's been interesting. And then the last question was tools, wasn't it? Tools and
Yeah, tools and techniques.
this is the part this is the part that I've struggled most with, I think, because there's, I guess, the beauty and the frustration with therapy is it's entirely self-led, and the therapist is not there to advise you or direct you. They're there to offer a space that you don't have anywhere else in your life, because if you go to a friend or a teacher or a parent or a family member, they all have a motive in listening to you. They want you to be happy. They want you to be this. They have some kind of stake in it. And so any advice you get will inevitably be influenced by that. Whereas a therapist, a lot of the time they stay silent. And that's so infuriating, I think, for people, especially when they first go to therapy and they're saying the stuff and the therapist doesn't say anything back. And it's like, I'm paying you. Why are you being silent?
Right, I could talk to myself in the mirror. I
Yeah,
actually do it quite often.
but it's this, I think it just offers a space that you can't find anywhere else. So I haven't been given any kind of, here's a technique or here's a thing. I think it's more resources that I've received, like the attachment style information. There's a, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like an interaction thing that you've got, like parent, adult, child, parent, adult, child. And it talks a lot about if we're interacting, usually I think every interaction we've had so far has been kind of adult to adult. It's been very accountable on our own parts and mature, and we take responsibility for ourselves and our role in things. But say, for example, I don't know, I was living with you and getting frustrated that you were being really messy, and you kind of said, well, just tell me what needs doing and I'll do it. Like, it's, you don't need to get so stressed about it. That kind of shifts this, where you kind of are taking the role of child, because you're saying, just tell me what to do. I want you to give me boundaries. I want you to give me this. And that inevitably puts me in the place of a parent. You can't interact as adult and child, because there's this kind of resistance to it. So I would then become lecturing, or I'd become nagging, or I'd become whatever. And it's about both parties in these interactions trying to maintain being in an adult space and taking responsibility for that. So yeah, it's more resources than lessons, I would say, but I think awareness is always the first step
Yes.
in change. So yeah.
I will share one tip. This is from the last therapist that I had.
One of the
And
last short-lived therapists.
he said, feel. Or I felt, I feel, I found. So when a situation happened and it's in the past and you're trying to review that situation, you use those three words. Like especially if it's in a conflict, like you said, it could either be a relationship or a platonic like friendship. I felt, so in the moment, I felt happy, sad, angry, blah, blah, blah. I feel that you, or I feel that because like now, where I guess like now in the present, I feel that I felt that because such and such, such and such, such and such. What I found that my conclusion is that I feel that, you know, you don't care, or like that makes me feel that you don't. So like using, and it was funny because when he introduced it to me, I was just not getting it. He was like, give me an example of how you would use this. And I was just butchering it and even explaining it, as you can tell, it's still kind of iffy, but it just gave me a different perspective where it's like, it basically opened my mind up to the fact that like in the moment you're allowed to have feelings. You don't have to act on those feelings, but you can have those feelings. And like you said, with continual learning and self-awareness about yourself, when you and when you encounter those feelings, you'll know how to act when those feelings come about. But if you don't even know what that feeling is, you're just going to continue to encounter that feeling and continue to react a certain way because you, again, you don't know the root cause of what caused you to feel that way, and or yeah, what caused you to feel that way in the moment. And then, like you said, with those spirals, like it's interesting because as you were drawing it and explaining it, I'm like, wow, like it makes total sense because everything's always a new experience. Like we're never the same age. Like time is always moving. So like for us to continue to go into situations the same way is very ignorant of us to do so and not step up our EQ, our emotional intelligence. Like it's necessary for us, like you were saying, even when we're in a healthy space to continue to, because I think that's when it's easier. The analogy popped up when you said that of like, it's easier to train when you're fully healthy than trying to train when you are sore, you're tired, you've been training for 3 days in a row, your ankles hurt. Like it's going to be a lot harder to train. But yeah, I know I went off in a tangent, but yeah, I think I wanted to, the last point I wanted to get to is how can we as adults and as humans in general, whether there's a teen listening, an adult listening, how can we cultivate these relationships and these communities where we can help each other heal? Because in a lot of communities, more so Eastern communities, therapy is not really a thing. And it's not really a thing because like there's this book by Oprah and Dr. Chopra, I think is his name. That might be his name, but it's called What Happened to You. And they talk about how African tribes, they didn't need therapy because they were always in community. So they were always able to connect with somebody. They were always able to hash something out with somebody. But with the invention of cell phones, and we see it more often now, like we don't really have intimate connections with individuals.
No, we
Like
feel like we do, I think,
we
but
feel like we
it's
do,
not the
like,
same.
but I think that's the trick of the devil right there, right? Like I'm on the phone, I got a bunch of friends on Instagram, but like if I'm really going through something and I needed some advice, I'm sure you could scroll through your friend list and there's probably not one or two, maybe one or two you actually feel comfortable.
Sharing that bit.
So like how can we create the environments, the community, the culture, the space to where people can share the things that are going on, good and bad, right? Because sometimes we get thrown off by wins too. People don't want to hear other people winning. Like, how can we create that community so we can like help each other heal? Because like you said, therapy is expensive.
I think the I found part of your I feel I found it is super important because as to your point that every experience we have informs like everything, like everything adds layers to what we know. And so I think if you just rely on the I felt or I feel, it can be really difficult sometimes when you're talking to someone who has an entirely different set of experiences. So like your version of angry and my version of angry, we know the word and we know the emotion roughly that it's supposed to construe, but how you feel in that, what triggers that, what helps you resolve that is going to be totally different to me. And so if we're just relying on I feel this and I feel that, emotion itself or it's emotion itself is fluid, it changes all the time, and a word, a description is so static that by the time you've told me you're angry, that emotion might have changed and my understanding of it has changed. And so I think by being able to recognize the actual impact and explore that as opposed to the feeling alone is crucial. And I think part of that is like the value of community in educating children and young people to explore those emotions, because there can be so much shame around negative emotions, and you know, kids are told to, especially young boys are told to toughen up or be less sensitive or don't be so girly, and girls are taught to think about other people's needs first, and feeling jealous is a bad thing. But actually, we still feel those emotions, as you were saying. Those emotions themselves are not negative things, it's what we choose to do with them. And if we've been told to bury them and had no education in learning to describe them or talk about them or how those made us feel, I found it there's a whole world of difficult emotions that are totally packed up and people don't know how to talk about them. So I think the first step is taking away the shame and the fear around emotions that don't inherently feel good.
Think since we're ping-ponging, I think the second step would be being curious. And I took this from you because you told me something about myself that I never really like noticed. I never really realized it until you like pointed it out. But you had said something like you seem like genuinely like curious about like people and like individuals. And I feel like if we as people remain curious when we're dealing with people and not think that, oh wow, just had a light bulb come off. If we remain curious, it takes out, I think we can take out the emotional side or our emotional reactions to it. Like if I could remain curious and be like, oh, why is she angry? Oh, let me like try to figure out why she. I think if we can be curious about the emotions that other people are having and be curious about the experiences that people go through, if we can maintain that curiosity, I think that gives that person that bubble of safety. 'Cause it's hard to like, again, like if you're trying to declutter your clothes, it's going to be very hard to do that. If you don't know that, no, if these clothes touch the ground, they're dirty now. So now I gotta like rewash them. So like if you know that you have a safe space or a basket, which is your friend, somebody who you can kind of toss these things at or toss these things off of, maybe not at them, then it'd be a lot easier for them to unpack those things and kind of throw away the dirty laundry.
I just also had a light bulb moment. So I think, you know, as I referenced earlier, labels of emotions are so, like, words themselves are so static and labels are so fixed. So I read a while back a book by Ibram X. Kendi. I think it's called How to Be an Anti-Racist. And one of the most like enlightening explorations in that is the fact that words that have previously or inherently are descriptive, words like racist or homophobic or rude or any of these things, they in and of themselves, they're descriptive terms. It's that was a racist thing that you said, or that was a rude comment. But in this society that we're in at the moment, and this apparent need to label things and define things, these descriptive words have been transitioned into nouns. So instead of you made a racist comment, it's you are racist or you are rude. It becomes an identity as opposed to this like fleeting description. It becomes fixed. And
Oh, wow.
nobody wants to think of themselves in a negative way. Nobody wants to view themselves as rude or view themselves as homophobic or, you know, whatever label that they've been defined as. And so when they're faced with that noun instead of a descriptive word or descriptive phrase, the defenses go up, the armor comes on, and they are not going to have any desire to reflect on that comment they made or the thing that they did. It's like this paralysis of shame and denial, and there is no room for growth when you are trying to like protect yourself. And you know, there's levels of this. So there are some people who are racist, who are rude, and who have such a resistance to exploration that they deserve those nouns. And I'm, you know, I'm not trying to excuse people who are inherently awful, but in day-to-day life where change can be made, where constructive conversations can happen, if you kind of stick someone in a very fixed label, there's no way to, as you say, then that is not a safe space to explore, to be curious, to go further.
Was like, since you know everything and you got your degree. And I think we'll end it on that right there. Cause like, but yeah, so like some of the major takeaways the listeners can have, I mean, remain curious, figure out how you felt in the moment, how you feel and what you found out about it. And continue to be like genuinely curious and open to like hearing about the experiences of other people. Cause you never know. You might be the first person that has actually like genuinely listened in a very long time. Like we're surrounded by people on a day-to-day basis. The tubes are crowded all day, every day. Restaurants is crowded. Like, but to have that connection and have somebody who can understand you and doesn't label you or doesn't. So like, I guess last thing too, on Thursday, we have like a men's group. We actually started it during COVID. Like right when like the George Floyd stuff and all that things were happening. So a group of young Black men every Thursday, and it's very, I ain't even gonna say young because we got some older guys like late 40s, early 50s in there. Well, it's just a space for us to come and talk. We can talk wins, we can talk losses, we can talk, you know, we share books and different things. Like we do like group reads and things like that. But I think in closing, if we can create more of those communities and more of like setting aside time to really analyze how do we actually feel, not the genuinely like how are you, oh yeah I'm good, whatever, but like space for us to genuinely like analyze how we feel, because again, like if you understand how you feel, I feel like it makes it a lot easier for you to respond in certain situations and be aware of the response you're going to have in those situations rather than react. And if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how would they get in touch? What's your gram? What's your Instagram?
Good question. It is L, so ELS Rose C, I think.
We'll fact check it for you. But until next time, y'all, peace with the toilet paper in the nose. Let's
Yeah, and the
go.
very sweaty England weather.
Yeah.
It's hot.
Peace. Is that water?